The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin. Welcome to Maltin on Movies. My guest today is somebody I've known a long, long time. Now, people sometimes ask me, are you friendly with filmmakers? Do you get to know these people? Do you hang out with directors? No, I'm a critic. That's a very awkward thing. How do you hang out with people that you're going to criticize? Not a smart idea, it seems to me. But this is somebody I know so long, it's before he was a filmmaker or I was a critic. That's how long. His name is Joe Dante, and he is known to you, of course, as the director of, of Gremlins, of Matinee, of The Burbs, of, Small Soldiers, et cetera, et cetera.
No need to reel them off.
There's a lot of them there. I mean, and the more intelligent and perceptive of you know that he's one of the creators of Rock and Roll High School and Roger Corman's Hollywood Boulevard and, of course, The Howling, et cetera. Talented guy who's been at it a long time and knows what's what. And also the creator of Trailers from Hell, a website that if you don't know about, you should. And we'll talk more about that in a minute. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Leonard.
If I'm not mistaken, we met as teenagers. We're both from Jersey.
Yes.
That is New Jersey, not the island out there in the other end of the world. And we met, I believe, at the home of the now mostly forgotten, but one time infamous Calvin T. Beck.
Redoubtable.
Yes, he certainly was that. The editor-publisher of Castle of Frankenstein magazine.
And who is allegedly the figure upon which Robert Bloch based Norman Bates in the book Psycho.
This is the legend that hovers around Calvin T. Beck.
It does, and it's largely due to his relationship with his mother.
Yes.
Who is a very overpowering figure.
Yes.
And who hardly ever let him out of her sight. He was well known for going to various conventions and, you know, fan gatherings and stuff, and always having his mother with him. And
yes.
she would hardly really literally let him out of her
no,
sight.
No, I once saw her knocking on the men's room door in the corridor outside Bill Everson's Theater Huff Film Society. Calvin, are you all right? I remember that vividly. Norman Bates never had that.
No, although Norman Bates was described physically in the book, nothing like Anthony Perkins. He was described quite a bit like Calvin. And Calvin was wall-eyed. He had one eye that looked one way.
Yes, and it was a very strange experience ever talking to him.
Because you never knew whether he was looking out the window or whether he was looking at you.
Right, and you didn't know where to put your eye contact because yours would start to drift along with his.
What's he looking at?
Oh, dear, yes.
But he was a very interesting guy.
Yes, he was. With a wonderful voice.
And he Orson Welles was his favorite, and he liked to imagine himself as a Wellesian figure, or maybe more of a Falstaffian figure. But his magazine was a riposte to Forrest Ackerman's Famous Monsters, which of course was the movie that alerted a lot of kids to the fact that there were others out there in the world like them.
That's right.
That loved these pictures, and it was
these pictures being the classic Universal horror films, the Lon
Chaney
fiction, silent films.
Yes, anything that was of what was then a generally derided genre.
Mm-hmm.
The phrase "monster kids" came to being because kids would all feel united by their love for this, you know, rather unappreciated genre. And Fari was a very punster kind of a guy, and he loved the movies, and he did a tremendous job bringing them to the public, and particularly getting them interested in silent films. When as kids aged a little and grew a little bit out of the magazine, they sort of hungered for something a little bit more sophisticated in terms of writing about movies, and so. Where Calvin came to the rescue was that he tried to emulate the British film magazines like Sight and Sound and Films and Filming, which was one of the few places you could go at the time for any kind of you know, intelligent writing about genre movies. And so there was a sort of a movement. It was also very New York. You know, Fari was very West Coast, and it was all Hollywood. And Fari was a kind of a gritty East Coaster. And so there was a bit more edge to the magazine. The problem was, of course, that he never had any money. The magazine came out incredibly irregularly. Oftentimes it would only end up on the stands for like a week, and then it would be pulled and the cover torn off and sold as a remainder. And so he never really made any money from the magazine, which came out incredibly infrequently. And you would have to literally hunt newsstands in Manhattan looking for the magazine, hoping that you'll hit the jackpot on the two or three days that it was really going to be available.
But you did for that magazine something that was really groundbreaking. It preceded my movie guidebook. It was an A to Z directory or compendium of capsule reviews of genre movies.
It's true. I was prior to your book, there was a book by Stephen Schur,
right?
And which was a creditable book, believe me. I mean, almost nobody had ever put together all these movies in one place. The problem was that he was very critical. Particularly of the kind of movies that I liked, and I think you must have sensed there was something missing, and also your book went into much more detail. It gave running times, it gave directors, it really was a film buff version. I think the Schur book was a sort of a nuts and bolts kind of for mom and pop to put on top of the TV, whereas your book actually appealed to cineasts and film fans. Mm-hmm. And but prior to that, there had really never been any listing in one place of all of these kinds of movies. And I thought, well, there's so many of them on television now, and that we could start with A, do the A's in one issue, and then do the B's and supposedly get all the way through the alphabet, which of course the magazine didn't live long enough to be able to do that.
But that would require 26 issues.
Well, it did. Well, and I don't think there really were 26 issues at all. I mean, how many issues can you put Star Trek on the cover of? I mean, that's what they were always reduced to. It's like, we got to sell something, put Star Trek on it. And the quality of the writing got a little better as I got older. Mm-hmm. And so by the time we got to the R's, which I think was the last one, they were actually fairly decent reviews. I think the legacy of Castle of Frankenstein is in retrospect somewhat even smaller than that of Famous Monsters, which is at least still continuing under new management.
Yeah, exactly. And oddly, maybe not oddly, maybe rightly, you and I have both sort of come full circle in an interesting way, because we're both back to pursuing what was originally our hobby or our avocation or love. Partly that's why I'm doing this podcast and my website, where I get to write whatever I want. No one tells me what to publish, what not to publish. And you are presiding over a really entertaining website called Trailers from Hell. Tell us about it.
Well, the idea from Trailers from Hell came because I started in trailers, making trailers for Roger Corman, and I collected 35 millimeter trailers, and I was a big fan. I loved trailers. When I was a kid, I'm the only person in the theater right now who doesn't get angry when they run 10 trailers before the movie because I like trailers. I'm sorry that the trailers today are also similar and that the movies are also similar,
yeah.
But that's another story.
Can't tell one from another.
But it seemed to me that as history rushes past us, that there were some interesting things being sort of swept away. And one of them was the interest in old movies, which when we were younger, the general culture included movies from the 30s and 40s and 50s, because that was what we saw all around us. There were only really in most places three stations.
This is before – we have to explain, and we always sound like old fogies, but we have to explain this is before not only before cable television and the 200 or 500 channel universe, and before specialty stations like Turner Classic Movies. It was before home video, certainly long before the internet, and we were all clinging desperately to what was shown on local television, local TV channels, which filled their airwaves almost 24 hours a day with old movies.
The cheapest programming that they could get.
That's
and
right.
Of course, they would also be in black and white, because most people have black and white televisions. They were pan and scanned. They were cut. They were the prints were scratchy, sometimes not very good.
But they were there,
and they were part of our lives. Mm-hmm. And we related to them in ways that people don't relate to them now, because they're not – they're their relevance is not the same to a young person of today as they were to us. And so, you know, I even went to the lengths of becoming a 16-millimeter film collector because that was really one of the only ways that you could have a film. You couldn't own a film. You couldn't run a film in your house, you know, unless you went and rented it at the camera store or someplace, and then you had to bring it back. Now, of course, you can own libraries. People have vast libraries of
films. Which you and I and our buddies could never have conceived of.
No, never. And first of all, the floor in my apartment wouldn't have been able to take it. I mean, when I put all those prints on top of each other, it started to bow the floor, and the guy downstairs complained. And, you know, so I ended up with my friends renting a vault when I came out here to bring a lot of 16-millimeter films. But now they don't even make projectors, let alone prints anymore. So video is now here to stay whether we like it or not. And it is a wonderful invention because you go back to the original negative, you can make an incredibly good copy. The sound is better. I mean, it's just we've lived to see something that none of us ever thought we would see, which is movies from the early 30s that were considered lost for 60, 70 years now being – I saw Robert Riskin's first directorial effort with Cary Grant is now being rescued and shown on Get TV, which is something that most people don't have. But still, it's there. It's things that we were just never able to see before. But the problem is that there needed to be somebody to curate this stuff because so many people today, there's just so much stuff to see that somebody needs to say, well, you know, you should see this movie. You should you find this actor interesting, this writer, this director. And so the impetus for Trailers from Hell was I had a bunch of trailers, and I thought I could put them up on the internet, but that would be kind of boring because everybody can do that. So I thought, well, I'll do a commentary track. So I took five pictures that I had always liked when I was a kid, and I did commentary tracks to the trailers, and I put them up for a while and to no particular interest on the part of anybody except some of my friends saw it and said, you know, I have a couple of pictures I'd like to talk about. Maybe we could get together. So people like John Landis and Edgar Wright and other director friends of mine, writer friends of mine, makeup people, Rick Baker, came aboard and started doing commentaries for trailers for various movies. So now we're up to – this is about 7 years ago, and now we're up to about 1,500 trailers with 40 different commentators. And of course,
it's including Larry Karaszewski, who was just here recently.
Larry Karaszewski, who is very good and very diligent. The only thing we haven't been able to master is making any money off of it. Uh-huh. So unfortunately, doesn't seem to be any way to do that.
Welcome to the club.
But nonetheless, it does. It's sort of a service in the sense that when somebody comes up to me and says, "You know, I had never heard of this movie until you guys featured it on your site. I went out and saw it. I really like it. I want to see other movies by this guy." Then it makes you feel like you're giving something back, you know, and that you're contributing to the culture.
Two words: Albert Zugsmith.
Well, as I have pointed out on the site, I may be the only commentator who has anything nice to say about Al Zugsmith, who was a famous exploitation director. Started as a producer, then later became a director. Was not known for his great taste, but nonetheless produced some pictures by Douglas Sirk, produced some pictures by Orson Welles. I mean, he really did contribute to the world, and he produced The Incredible Shrinking Man, which was always one of my favorite movies. On the other hand, he did do Sex, Kittens, Go to College, which is not necessarily one of my favorite movies, and Invasion USA, which is a fairly interesting hoot from 1952. And I find him an interesting filmmaker. And so these are movies that are pretty obscure. And any way that you can get people interested in, which has allowed us to hook up with places like Warner Archive, which has a bunch of pictures that Zugsmith worked on. Mm-hmm. Most importantly, Confessions of an Opium Eater, which I think is a sort of an accidental masterpiece. And we've been able to cross-plug. Mm-hmm. And so they do us a favor, we do them a favor. There's no money changes hands. It's not, you know, none of us are going to the bank about this. But it's a way of getting the word out about some things that people might ordinarily not see.
I have a vivid – I can't explain it, but I have a vivid memory of my parents taking me to the Paramus, New Jersey drive-in, long gone, and seeing the trailer. We were not going to see this film, but we saw the trailer for The Private Lives of Adam and Eve with Mamie Van Doren as Eve with her long blonde tresses covering – her breasts, still very titillating for a young boy. And Mickey Rooney as the snake in the Garden of Eden. That's my key memory. I don't think I ever actually sat and watched the movie start to finish, but I've never forgotten those images.
I'm not so sure that anybody has watched that movie in many years because, for one thing, it's just not available. There are certain kinds of movies that are owned by studios, and if the studios are not interested in doing anything with them, they just sit there because nobody else can do anything with them. That happens to be one of them. I bought a bunch of trailers recently, and there was on the reel a trailer for The Private Lives of Adam and Eve, which was one of those tricky movies from the 60s where they would say, see the devil in spectacolor. Well, and if you go to the movie, you do see the devil in spectacolor, but only in the scenes where the devil appears, because the rest of the movie is in black and white. That's the way they used to save a lot of money. And it's one of those wayward bus things where you've got a whole bunch of people on a bus and they have a dream sequence and they all imagine that they're counterparts of people in heaven or hell or wherever. And it's a pretty silly movie. But obviously it was he was trying to push censorship as far as it would go. He did mm-hmm. that also on High School Confidential and College Confidential, where he would, dare I use the word, smut. I mean, he would get as close to smut as he could get away with.
Near smut, neo-smut.
Neo-smut.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. What were your – did you have a plan? Did you have a goal at that time in your young life when you were becoming immersed in these films? You loved them. You started writing about them. And did you see yourself becoming a filmmaker?
I really loved movies. It was like going to church for me. Mm-hmm. I was at every Saturday matinee. I knew a lot of stuff about movies, more than any other kid in my class. And but one day I went to see Lord of the Flies, which was the 1963 version that Peter Brook made, which I had loved the book and I wanted to see the movie. So I went to New York, the Lowe's Tower East, and saw the movie and really thought it was great. I must have – the Trailways bus people made a lot of money from me because I used to go back. And while it was playing at that theater, I must have seen it, four or five times. But one day I just started to count the shots. And after I got over 100, I realized, well, I can't do this. I mean, math was my worst subject. And the idea of having all of this stuff in my head and being able to do all this work and figure out how to – I figured it's just totally beyond me. So I went into writing about movies, and then I went to art school where they said I better take a film course because I wanted to be a cartoonist, and you can't be.
And this was in Philadelphia, right?
Philadelphia College of Art, then called. Now it's called the University of the Arts. And so I took a film class, and this was in like 1965 and six, where it was all 16 millimeter film. It was silent. It was black and white. There was no sound, and there was no cameras. I mean, there were literally two or three cameras, and there were 40 students, and so everybody did their film at the very last minute. And I learned absolutely nothing about making films. But what I did do when I was in Philadelphia was I went to the grindhouses, and I went to the theaters that were still showing pictures like the News Theater on Market Street, which was a long corridor with a square screen on the end, which was built to show newsreels during World War II and was open 24 hours a day so people could come from the factories and they could see the latest newsreels. And they would also – so now it was a revival house and they just ran anything they could get. Unfortunately, if they ran a CinemaScope movie, it would say filmed in Intimascope because half the movie would be on the wall and the other half would be on the screen. But nonetheless, they ran a lot of great movies and a lot of old stuff because in Philadelphia there was an exchange there where films from the 30s were still being sent out. And I see Cagney and Bogart and all that stuff. Freaks, that was very popular. They used to run that a lot. And right across the street from that was the Family Theater, the ill-named Family Theater, which was a true grindhouse. It smelled terrible.
Can you try to Quentin Tarantino made a quite wonderful film called Grindhouse.
Well, which flopped because nobody knew what a grindhouse was.
Exactly. Can you define it?
Actually, it was a double feature, and some people left after the first movie because the concept of a double feature was so alien to them. What, there's two? Why would there be two? The grindhouses were basically where movies went to die. You would run three movies on a loop. They would never turn on the lights, ever. There'd be cartoons, there'd be shorts, there'd be lots of things to see. But you just – they never cleaned them. They never turned them on unless, as in at the Family Theater, there was the occasional murder in the theater. And then even then when the police arrived, they wouldn't turn the lights on. I was watching Mario Bava's Whipping the Body – And somebody got excited and stabbed the guy next to them. And
as happens.
As happens. You know, right, what are you going to do? It was exciting. It was Christopher Lee and Valley Lobby. It was like, you know, people were just on the ceiling. And you'd have to often have to change seats because, you know, if there were molesters or gropers or something, you wouldn't want to leave the movie because God knows when of you would ever see it again.
Right.
So you just move down a couple. And then they would do things like they ran the day the earth caught fire and they turned the temperature up so hot that everybody would run to the refreshment stand to spend money on the refreshments. The problem with that was you couldn't go to the bathroom down there because that wasn't done.
Yeah.
And so you couldn't drink too much while you're watching the day the earth caught fire or else it was bad. But and 42nd Street was the same way. You know,
yeah.
I mean, people used to get peed on from the balcony in 42nd
Street. Well, the story I've always heard that a friend told me and swears is not apocryphal is that he heard from the balcony of a 42nd Street theater in the middle of a movie, "You're sorry. You're sorry. You pee on my date and you say, I'm sorry?"
That does not sound apocryphal.
No, not at all. Our mutual friend John Davison, John and I used to go to movies together on 42nd Street because you would not go alone or you try
no,
not
no,
to
you
go
don't
alone.
Want to go on.
You wanted
it's
to have
the buddy system.
The buddy system, exactly so. Oh, goodness. So anyway, so you absorbed everything you could.
I did, and when it came time to not be able to be a cartoonist and to figure out film and look through the camera and photograph things, and I got a job writing for a magazine called Film Bulletin, a very old, venerable trade magazine in Philadelphia. And when John Davis and my friend went out to California to work for Roger Corman in the publicity department, he asked me if I wanted to come out and make a trailer for a movie called The Student Teachers that our friend Jonathan Kaplan was directing for Roger. And I said, sure, why not? I mean, I don't know. I let's see if this is something I can do. And I had made a film with John called The Movie Orgy, which was a 7-hour compilation film. So I knew the rudiments of editing in 16 millimeter. I did not know much about 35 millimeter. And so when left alone in a room with a moviola and a print of a film, I was at sea. I had to like go and knock on doors and ask the other editors what to do. But that's the way things worked at the Corman factory. You learned while doing.
So this one, his company was called New World Pictures.
New World Pictures. It was Roger's. He had formed it after he decided – he kind of got disillusioned with directing because he'd been working at AIP and they'd been recutting his movies. And so he decided to start his own company. And it was a non-union company, which meant that anybody could work there. And you didn't necessarily have to have any experience. You just need to have verve and – interest, and he was very good at spotting talent and people who really wanted to work hard to get somewhere. And this was one of the few venues in Hollywood in the 70s that you could do that. There was Crown International. There were a couple of other Dimension, a couple of other pictures companies that made films like this. But this was the creme de la creme. And after doing a trailer for a picture that made money, I got to do a trailer for another picture that made money, and somehow I was erroneously associated with the fact that these movies had made money because of the trailers. And so my friend Alan Arkush, who was doing trailers with me, and I and John went to Roger and said, we'd like to make a movie. And he said, well, you can make a movie, but it's got to be the cheapest movie that I've ever made here, and you've only got 10 days to do it, and you got to keep making the trailers because we can't have any interruption in continuity. So we realized the only way we could make a movie that was even halfway releasable under that situation was to make a movie centered around scenes from other movies, which we had had so much experience on the Movie Orgy with. And so having made trailers for a whole bunch of different kinds of pictures that they were releasing, we concocted a story about a movie company making these kind of movies, which allowed us to dress our actors up like the people in the clips and use all the action scenes from the various pictures that we've been working on and make our movie look more expensive than it really was. And it was sort of a home movie of what it was like to work for Roger Corman at that time in Hollywood.
And that, of course, was Hollywood Boulevard.
Hollywood Boulevard, the street where starlets are made.
And legend has it that it was $50,000 budget?
It was $50,000 or $60,000. It also played on 42nd Street for 2 days and was pulled. Which is some kind of record, I'm sure.
For lack of interest?
I don't know. I didn't like it. And my brother went to see it because he was living in New Jersey, and he said he'd never been in a theater where they kept the lights on during the entire movie.
Well,
but from that, from humble beginnings.
Yes, exactly. We're going to explore some more of those humble beginnings and the aftermath as well when we come back. So stay tuned. I'll be back with Joe Dante in just a minute. Today's episode of Malton on Movies with Baron Vaughn is sponsored by Howl FM. We think you're going to like what you hear with Howl. It's kind of like Netflix for podcasts. With Howl Premium, you get exclusive access to more than 120 hours of Howl originals, featuring exclusive miniseries, comedies, and documentaries, with new episodes added every week. You get all the archives from WTF with Marc Maron, and all the Earwolf and Wolfpop shows like Comedy Bang Bang, How Did This Get Made, and Our Little Show. Plus more than 60 great comedy albums, including Baron Vaughn's Raised by Cable. Get access to all of this exclusive content on your iPhone, your Android phone, or on the web for only $4.99 a month. And with the promo code MALTIN, that's M-A-L-T-I-N, you get a full month of free trial. Nothing to lose. So to redeem your promo code, make sure you create your account on the web at Howl, H-O-W-L dot F-M, and then enter the code MALTIN at checkout. So go to Howl FM, use the promo code MALTIN, and you'll get a one-month free trial of Howl Premium. Check it out for yourself. Listen to Spalding Gray, or Forgotten Classics, or the Canon Commentaries, or something cool. There's a wide variety of material available to you, and I think you'll enjoy checking it out. And thanks to Howl for sponsoring. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin. This is Maltin on Movies, and my guest today is Joe Dante, and we're talking about early days. You know, I don't think of us as ancient. I don't think we are ancient.
Everybody else does.
Well, I know that, but that's their problem. But the period we're describing and the experiences we had both as moviegoers and then as young professionals in our respective fields, me writing and you filmmaking – does seem like almost like a fairy tale, something from another truly another era.
I think we were really lucky.
Me too.
I mean, it's not lucky that we're so old now. that's the bad part.
Yeah, screw
but
that.
But the good part was that we were there at the end of the beginning, at mm-hmm. the end of the golden age. Mm-hmm. Physically, the town looked different. It's not the same business that we were in. In 1975, the way that movies were made, the way they were sold, the way they were seen was diametrically opposed to the way it is now. We don't even make movies on film anymore. We don't make movies that show, for the most part, in theaters. Mm-hmm. The majority of movies go directly to some sort of video release. Whether it's home, streaming, or you end up seeing it basically on your home, maybe on your phone. Hopefully it's not Lawrence of Arabia, but, you know. What I find myself wondering, and this was one of the reasons we started Trailers from Hell, you know, we all know what made us want to be in the business and what made us love movies and the personalities that engaged us. And when I look around today at what's made and what's generally seen and by whom it's seen, I just wonder where the passion would come from on the part of a young person who wants to be in the business. I mean, quote, be in the business means a lot of things. It can mean, you know, having a big swimming pool and getting laid all the time. I mean, that's the fantasy about what – but that's not why most of my friends got in the business. You know, anything else was ancillary. If those were – good thing that you made a lot of money. That would be nice. You got a big pool. You got a car. That's very nice. But that's not why you did it. And I just wonder where the passion comes from today. Who wants to make Spider-Man 6? You know, is that Transformers 9? Is that really what people want to do with their lives?
Well, I suppose I'm the last one to play devil's advocate on this particular topic. But I suppose that Star Wars instills a kind of excitement and a kind of sense of wonder in a lot of fans.
Well, I say certainly the new one did.
That's what I mean.
But yeah. I think it did by cleverly trading on what was groundbreaking about the first one.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, it's really essentially a remake of the original Star Wars movie, mm-hmm. Down to the art direction. Mm-hmm. And they were very clever in mining, I think, the things that excited people then – and excite them now still mm-hmm. as older people and also are attractive enough to, you know, to excite young people. And that's very clever. I don't know that you can do that with every franchise.
No.
It's certainly becoming
difficult. Although J.J. Abrams has done pretty well. I mean his reboot of Star Trek, the first one in particular.
No, the Star Trek reboots are very clever. I think the superhero reboots, however, are little more problematic.
Yeah, I think so too.
It's very difficult to not be making the same movie over and over. And then when you have a movie where you've got one superhero who's going to fight another superhero, and the only way you can do it is by robbing one of the superhero of the powers that would allow him to beat the other superhero. It's sort of cheating, you know?
Oh, dear. Now, one thing that you were able to do that allowed you to work in the commercial mainstream and still indulge your personal taste and love and passion was hiring veteran actors when you first started making films. And to the delight of people like me who shared your, you know, your fondness for these folks, you got wonderful, wonderful people. William Shallard, of course, is in a lot of your films.
Yes. You do find that when you look back at Sturges or Ford or Bergman or anybody, you see the same people over and over because mm-hmm. they become your friends. You like them. You know what they can do. You appreciate them. You've always appreciated them, which is why you hired them in the first place.
Yeah.
And so it's not surprising that they would turn up over and over, and it sort of becomes part of your signature. Mm-hmm. It's also just a hell of a lot of fun to meet people that you grew up watching and to work with them and to actually, you know, become friends with them. I mean, a day on the set with Keenan Wynn is all I had. It was one day on Piranha. And it was – everything he did was memorable. Everything he said was memorable. Hmm. And the only sad part is that when you're making a movie that quick, you don't have enough time to sit and listen to the stories that he's probably telling to the makeup guy.
Yeah.
You know? But it's
– I remember you telling me that on The Howling, you did the slate – you actually operated the slate – so that you could sit next to John Carradine.
Well, when he would start a story and then, you know, you say, oh, it's time to shoot, and you're not going to hear the end of the story. So I'd say, don't worry, we'll do another take. And so, I'd do another take just so I could hear the end of the story. And they were great stories, and he was a wonderful guy. And it just was reaching the point at which he was having trouble with his lines, which I have encountered with various actors, and it's always a terrible moment for them because not just because they can't remember, but because they're in front of other actors.
Sure.
And but it's I remember when I was doing trailers at Rogers in Hollywood, and there was a knock on the door, and it was Kent Smith, who was looking for some place where he apparently was going to do ADR or something, and he couldn't remember the name of the movie. And he couldn't remember whether he was in the right place or not. Mm-hmm. And he had obviously reached that point in his career where, you know, he was not remembering things well. But he sure looked great.
I mean, that's the leading man of Cat People.
Yeah.
Wow.
So anyway, that's one of the best things about being able to make movies is to work with those kind of people. And the other thing is I was lucky that I became popular doing genre, which allowed me to stick more of my personality into the movie than I would ordinarily probably be able to do because there was always the story to sell it, the special effects to sell it, the monster to sell it, whatever it is. And so you could have an attitude about it that would be okay as long as it didn't interfere with what was commercial about the movie. And so I would say up until the 2000s, I really could stand behind every picture I did and say, you know, for good or ill, I take responsibility for that movie. You know, there were exceptions where they just released the movie where it wasn't finished and they just said put it out anyway. But for the most part, it was like, yes, this is – I can say this is a Joe Dante movie, whatever that is, you know. Mm-hmm. Later when you do a lot of television, it's not quite the same because you're coming in on somebody else's show with their cast and their plot problems and their character arcs and stuff. And you don't have that much ability to affect things because you really have to do it in their style because it's their show.
One film you did that I liked that very few people got to see is The Hole, which is just a few years ago.
Very few people, indeed.
And where you gave a wonderful part to Bruce Dern. And this is just before he got that terrific part in Nebraska with Alexander Payne. But Bruce has never lost his mojo.
No, Bruce is a great guy, and he became a very good friend. He asked me when he got a star on the Hollywood Boulevard, he asked me to do his speech, his introduction. I was flattered. I mean, I couldn't believe he would ask me. But he's a wonderful guy, terrific guy, and talk about stories.
I mean, oh, yes.
There's a guy he knows what Jesse Lasky ate for breakfast. I mean, it just comes out, you know. And now I'm very happy that he's, you know, in his later years, he's been so exalted. He's really terrific in Nebraska.
Mm-hmm. And in The Hole.
And in The Hole.
Yeah, he's fun. I do remember you saying long, long, long time ago, when we were chatting about something or other, that some of the magic as a moviegoer was robbed from your DNA when you became a movie maker. That is, am I quoting you right?
I probably said something like that. You can't quite watch movies with the purity mm-hmm. that you could before you started making them, because you know so much about how it was done. I seem to remember a quote from Boris Karloff where he said he tried not to see his movies too recently after he had made them because he was so aware of what went into making them, and mm-hmm. would, like, wait for years before he watched some of them. Some of them he just didn't watch at all. But I really actually am a pretty good audience in the sense that I can watch a mystery that I've seen 20 times and not remember who did it. You know, it's like I can mm-hmm. will myself to not, so I can mm-hmm. enjoy it all over again. Mm-hmm. And when you go to a movie, you're quite aware of all the things that go on. Not as many as you used to be, because now there's so much CGI in movies in places that nobody knows there's CGI. Just to make a normal street look normal, you know, and put a different sky in, to take out the trees, take out the TV aerials or whatever, you know, and it looks fine. I mean, that Eastwood movie, The Changeling, was a phenomenal portrait of a Los Angeles that doesn't exist anymore. And mm-hmm. it was very convincing. But I do try to not pay much attention to that sort of thing. And every so often something will hit you as it would if I was still being a critic. Mm-hmm. For instance, when I saw 13 Cloverfield Lane.
10 Cloverfield Lane.
Yeah. Which I liked. Mm-hmm. I was aware of how loud the music was mixed and how overbearing it was. And I like Bear's what's his name? Bear – he did music for Battlestar Galactica. I can't remember his first name is Bear, but anyway, I like him. But it was as if the people who made the movie didn't have enough faith in their own picture, and so they felt that every time there was a dialogue scene about the characters, that they had to crank up the music lest people would be bored. And from my own experience, I can sort of relate that to previews, to the preview that you have to do. For the studio, where you have a scene that you think is important to the movie and the studio doesn't think so. And so they sit and wait for somebody to walk out or go to the bathroom during the scene and then point out later, see, somebody left. They didn't like it. As a filmmaker, that's sort of the bane of your existence, is that you have to show the movie to people sooner or later. and it's so hard to hang on to your treasured moments when there's organized resistance, as there often is for various reasons, to something that you think is important. And in this case, it just seemed to me it was a case of somebody saying, well, you know, they're getting kind of restless. Don't you think we should pump mm-hmm. up the volume a little
yeah,
bit?
Yeah. Well, I know that you have
– Bear McCrory.
Bear McCrory. There we are. I was pleasantly surprised by that movie.
Me too. Because I wasn't that crazy about the first one. And this was, I think, actually developed as a separate film.
Oh, yeah. I don't think it had anything to do with
and
the
then,
other
so let's
one,
do the Cloverfield thing,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, of course, you directed John Goodman in one of my favorite films of yours, Matinee,
yes.
which is like shooting fish in a barrel, showing it to people like me, because it's about the kind of movie making and the kind of movie showmanship that we grew up loving, namely that of William Castle, the famous producer-director who – well, he wasn't famous, but he –
He was sort of famous.
He tried to. Yeah, he was almost famous.
Well, he was a self promoter. He did what Hitchcock and DeMille had managed to do, which was to make themselves the center of attention for each of their movies, and mm-hmm. so thereby marketable. And so Castle took that on himself and became a personality. And he would introduce his trailers, and he did a column for Famous Monsters, which was very condescending, as if he was writing for little tiny tots. He managed to personify himself into a bankable figure, with the gimmicks. And so the character that Goodman plays is nominally based on Castle, although. You know, he brings a giant bug movie to town. Castle didn't really do giant bug movies, and it's more Jack Arnold or somebody like that. But it's a composite of various people. But it's a nice movie, and it's, you know, it was set during the Cuban Missile Crisis, during which many people of my age, including probably you, although you're a little younger than me, but we thought that there was no school on Monday. And we thought there was no school on Tuesday or Wednesday or ever again, because we really thought that this was the last weekend.
Yeah.
And a lot of that, you know, personal reminiscence spills over into that movie.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I saw William Castle's 13 Ghosts twice. I was so enamored of it, and it was such an incredible experience. Here's how it went, folks. It was an old dark house type mystery. And when you went into the theater, you were greeted on screen by the filmmaker, William Castle. "Hello, I'm William Castle, and you're about to see 13 Ghosts, my latest film." And then he'd explained how to use the Ghost Viewer Ghost Remover, which didn't look like 3D glasses. It was a piece of cardboard with two pieces of cellophane, one red and one blue. And so when the scary scenes were going to come, he would explain. He said, "Tell this to a friend if a friend comes in late." I remember that. If you wanted to see the ghosts during the scary scenes, you look through the red portion. And if you wanted to block out the ghosts, you look through the blue portion of the Ghost Viewer Ghost Remover. And I mean, to a kid of 11 or 12, this was just Valhalla.
Oh, it was interactive. I mean, exactly. We never got interactive stuff.
So I went back to see it again. I had to experience it again. And then about, 25 years ago, they showed it at the New Art Theater here in L.A., and Bill Castle's daughter Terry came and all that. What a terrible movie. It's inexplicably bad.
It's a kid's movie with a kid protagonist. It's the only picture Charles Herbert ever had first milling in.
Yeah.
You know, it's a silly movie, but it has some pretty good ghosts in it.
Yeah.
And makeups. And has Margaret Hamilton.
Yes, exactly. You know? No, it's not without its assets, but they are
Well, it's hardly his worst movie. I mean, there's a couple of other contenders.
Well, we needn't go into that. Now, you also had a flirtation with filmmakers that one might not expect when you were working for Roger Corman at New World. I seem to recall you cut the trailer for Federico Fellini's Amarcord.
Roger was taking advantage of something that was going on in the zeitgeist, which was that the major studios had decided that they weren't making enough money with these art films that imported from Europe. And United Artists was the main distributor, and they decided they just didn't want to do this anymore. And so these pictures were on the market. It started with Cries and Whispers, the Bergman movie, which Roger bought at a festival and told Bergman, "I can get your movie seen by more people than have ever seen a Bergman movie because I can play drive-ins. And all we have to do, if we just do a dubbed version," this was back when dubbing was acceptable, "you know, we can get your movie." And sure enough, it won Academy Awards. And so Roger decided that he had a new sideline. In addition to making Women in Cages movies, he was going to distribute European art films. And one of them was Amarcord, which we were handed over an Easter weekend, I remember, handed the Italian trailer, which was with no subtitles, and said, "We've got to do an American trailer for this movie." But I didn't even know what people were saying, and I hadn't seen the movie. I'd only seen the trailer. And so we got a couple of reels of the movie, and we put together our own version of the trailer. Now, a Roger Corman version of a Fellini trailer is a little different than the Italian version, because the Corman version was filled with racing cars, rear ends, sex, breasts. It's as suggestive as it could possibly be, and all to Nino Rota's music. You people hear people say a few lines in Italian, but otherwise, there's no indication that it's an Italian movie. And so we did the trailer, and I was told that Fellini thought this was a much better trailer than the Italian trailer.
What a compliment.
It was
great.
No, it was wonderful. And he distributed Truffaut, and Truffaut came and we met him, and he distributed a picture that Jean Moreau directed, and we did the trailer for that. We met her. So that it was a really nice cosmopolitan kind of time to be there, because not only were we working with, you know, exploitation people and people just starting out like John and Demi, but with these European masters.
Amazing. Amazing. And this is too trivial, I guess, for some people, but not for me. You also, I believe, got your – was it the Amarcord trailer you got printed by the Technicolor company?
It was the last trailer, in fact, the last thing printed in Technicolor by the Technicolor company, which used to be over on Seward on Cole Street. And it had a giant – it was amazing. They had this giant building, huge building, and all the film was on one strip. And there was a guy at one end with a console, and as the film went by, he would adjust the colors. And the movie would go the film itself, the dye transfer stuff, would be go all over the room, all over the building in these little conduits and come out at this other end. And there were three – there was blue, cyan, and magenta, which they would press it on the film as dyes. It wasn't photographed.
When you hear about three-strip Technicolor, folks, which was came around in the 1930s and which made vivid – some people would say garish, but vivid, beautiful colors that lasted, that didn't fade as the later Eastman Color film stock did. It was called three-strip Technicolor because of those three colors, yellow, cyan, and magenta. And they were kind of sandwiched, weren't they?
They were two on one side, one on the other. They were pressed onto the film. And if you held up the film, you could see the indentations. It was a beautiful technique. But it became only worth doing if you printed a lot of them. Because if you only printed a few prints, then it was a very expensive process. And at that particular time, the idea of doing thousands of prints was going away. And so what happened is that after they printed that trailer, and I think Godfather 2, which was the feature that was running at the same time, they took all – they dismantled machines and sent them to Red China. And so for years, Chinese movies, in which the predominant color is red anyway, which is the color it fades to, were being printed in this process. And now I think – and there was a brief attempt maybe 15, 20 years ago to print some release prints of a Batman movie or something like that in – classic Technicolor, and it was an archival thing, and I think they felt that they, but I don't know that now that they don't print prints at all anymore.
Yeah,
how any of that has fared because you know it's all kind of obsolete with a digital.
But you had the last taste.
We did have the last taste, and I still have that trailer, and it still hasn't faded.
Of course, it hasn't. nor has our enthusiasm for Technicolor, and we'll talk. When we come back, I'm going to ask Joe to recommend, as we always do on the show, some movies that you ought to see that maybe you haven't. And it'll take him a long time to think of some, I know, because he doesn't traffic in this kind of conversation. But we'll twist his arm, and I bet he can come up with a few titles. We'll be right back.
Hi, everybody. This is David Gregory, and I want to tell you about my new podcast, The David Gregory Show. It is that easy to remember. And it's me talking to all sorts of really interesting people, getting them off their regular script into deeper, more personal conversations, like Arianna Huffington about parenthood.
I think especially for mothers, they take the baby out and they put the guilt in.
Or Bravo TV's Andy Cohen on being less afraid.
Look, I'm a single gay dude on a late night talk show. If I can't overshare, who can?
We'll have a new program every Friday. So go to iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever your favorite podcast app and download The David Gregory Show and eavesdrop on really cool conversations. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to the final segment of this edition of Maltin on Movies. I'm Leonard Maltin. I'm here with Joe Dante, who, as you see, needs a lot of persuasion to talk about movies. But I've worked my magic. I've waved the magic wand, and he is graciously obliged. A friend of mine says, the only thing better than watching movies is talking about them. It is fun to talk about movies.
It is, and it's actually become a kind of a lost art, because the thing I used to love about movies, particularly in college, is we'd go to a movie, we'd like Mickey 1, which is a movie I loved and still love. And Arthur Penn's movie with Warren Beatty, and very cryptic movie. And we would talk about it. We would argue about it. We would opinionate about it. And sometimes people would take issue with things. And it was a discussion like people have over religion, you know? I mean, it was exciting. And today, it's not just that the movies aren't worth talking about, which is true in many cases, but it's just there are so many other things going on in people's lives, that it going to the movies and savoring the experience later becomes a lot less important to people than it used to be. Now, for instance, to talk about a movie you can see, I saw a movie called Eye in the Sky, which is out right now, and I think is a terrific movie.
Good movie.
And filled with talking points, filled with interesting moral dilemmas.
This is a film about drone warfare. With a fantastic cast, Helen Mirren, who's awfully good in it, no surprise, the late Alan Rickman, Jeremy Northam, a lot of good people.
And a very well-made movie by a South African director, and which deals with – it reminded me of Failsafe in a lot of ways, and that it deals with the morality of war. And so that's the kind of movie that we don't get that much of anymore. It's a little more difficult to come out of a Transformers movie, and not that I want to pick on that particular series because
it just
seems to encapsulate to me movies that where you have to check your brain at the door.
Yeah.
And when you come out, it's like, you know, you could talk about how many effect shots there were, mm-hmm. or how overextended the climax was, or mm-hmm. how many climaxes there were. I mean, you may have noticed that, you know, you can't have a movie today without 12 climaxes.
Yeah.
Any one of which would have been big enough for a James Bond movie in the 70s.
Yeah.
But now it's only one of many, many, many climaxes, mm-hmm. Which I think is unfortunate. And I think the audience gets jaded. It actually gets boring. And no matter how great the effects are, if you're not invested in the characters and you're not invested in the story and you don't really care how it comes out, it doesn't matter how good it looks. And movies look as good or better than they've ever looked today, mm-hmm. because the technology is so terrific and there's so many good people doing things. I mean, you do now come out humming the art direction.
Mm-hmm.
But the content, where's the content? Well, the content is largely on cable television. You know, you can watch a show like Outlander, which is a time travel period show, which is coming up, I think, on its second season, which has more ideas per episode than most of these movies have in their entire running time, and so it's a time of great upheaval and change in the way that we process our entertainment and the way it's made and for whom it's made. And it's exciting in a sense that, you know, we really don't know what's going to happen. I mean, you could say that about the presidential election. It's exciting, but it's also depressing because the many scenarios that you could think of are – most of them are just not that attractive. But it's the world we live in, and it's changed – technology has changed it immensely. We still have movies. We still go to theaters, luckily, because kids will always want to get out of the house, and so there will always be theaters. But I think it's really going to be much more of an event. Kind of a thing.
Then it already is, really,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, and the prices are, you know, event prices. Mm-hmm. You know, but for me, the fun of it is that looking back, we have all of film history basically at our disposal. I mean, there's still some outliers that we don't know where they are, or movies that are not distributed very well. But if you want to have somebody go through the collected works of Edward L. Kahn, a director who made a lot of low-budget movies from the 30s to the 60s. Practically the entire library is available. It's there. You can see those movies if you care to. And I think that's terrific. So to try to point people toward movies that they might not have seen, or I'm giving recommendations now. One of my favorite directors is a guy named John Farrow, who is Mia Farrow's father. Who directed a lot of pictures.
And Maureen O'Sullivan's husband.
Right, and directed a lot of pictures for Paramount in the 40s. And he's a very stylish director. There's a movie called The Big Clock, which with Ray Milland, which he made, which is from a script by Jonathan Latimer, who wrote a lot of his movies. And it's a terrific whodunit where the victim is looking for his own self. He's supposed to be the murderer but he's not. Charles Laughton is in it, George McCready. It's a terrific movie, also Lanchester. It was remade, interestingly, as a Kevin Costner movie called No Way Out, mm-hmm. which was set in Washington. Instead of the original movie set in the publishing world, this was set in the newspaper Washington world. And it's a very clever remake up to the last minute, because the last minute of the movie pulls a trick that so alienated the audience that they booed the picture when I saw it. I'm not going to tell you what it is. But otherwise, it's a very clever remake, and I'm mm-hmm. not a big fan of remakes. He did another picture called
The Big Clock is a terrific movie,
I guarantee.
And I don't remember who did the production design or art direction, but it's a great-looking movie.
It's a great-looking movie, and also it's a fluid movie in a way that movies are not anymore, because the sets were all built in a way that there's a missing wall. So mm-hmm. if somebody goes through a door, there's no side to the other side, so the mm-hmm. camera can go directly through rooms without making it's not a stagey effect, although on set it must have looked like a big stage, mm-hmm. like a Ladies' Man or something. But it took me several viewings to actually realize why this picture was so clever. Another movie he did called Alias Nick Beale with Ray Milland, again as a sort of a devil character who is the devil. He's not the devil, he's a devil.
A devil.
I think he's a devil. But he's tempting Thomas Mitchell, who is a crusading congressman or something, and he's taking him to the dark side. And George MacReady actually plays a good guy in that picture, which is very rare. But anyway, it's a wonderful movie, very stylish, very atmospheric. Not easy to see. Every so often, TCM runs it.
Yeah.
It's not on video yet. There's another movie that I don't want to send people the movies they can't find.
Right, right. Well, I mean, last week I happened to log on to Trailers from Hell and saw you touting the glories of Abbott Costello and Hold That Ghost. Now, I suppose there are a lot of people who've never seen Abbott Costello, younger people who've never.
Which is interesting because they were the most popular comedy team in America from the 40s through the mid early 50s
when
Martin and Lewis came. Mm-hmm. But I mean, they were huge.
Yep,
they were like number two at the box office.
Yep.
And they joked with presidents. I mean, they were really part of even more so than Hope and Crosby. I think they were really touchstones for people. And now, because the movies are dated and they're not run that often, they did a TV show which ran in syndication through I would say the 90s,
seemingly forever. Yes.
And I think a lot of people who never saw the movies saw the TV show because it was on Saturday mornings, and so I think there is some residual. Affection for them because of that. But I think you could say that about Martin and Lewis. I mean, Jerry Lewis certainly is still a presence, but the movies that he made with Dean Martin are not really that well known. Mm-hmm. And the Hope and Crosby movies, which are very, very clever and very forward thinking in terms of the way that they use the cinema, are movies that just aren't on people's radar anymore. And it's because that was then. You know, and people find it difficult to relate to the wartime jokes and and it's true of the Warner Brothers cartoons that we all love that from the 40s and 50s that are really not they're put out every so often in special, you know, albums and you know, stuff like that, and they have to have the disclaimer because there's so many things in it that now are not quite PC. But the attempt always is to try to make animaniacs out of them and to make new things out of them that are vaguely related to what they originally were. Mm-hmm. And it's what happens. It's just what happens when, you know, time goes by.
Right. I mean, you know, and I'm not recommending anybody live in the past. I mean, you and I don't live in the past, but we enjoy things from the past. And I find it interesting that I think it's only movies that get pigeonholed this way. No one refers to that old play, Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah.
Or that old novel, Huckleberry Finn. You know, it's only movies that –
But that's because movies date in a special way because of the visuals and because of music choices and because of acting styles. Mm-hmm. And they can become creaky. I mean, these are like silent movies were to us when we were growing up. I mean, those were old 20 years ago. Well, that's a long time ago. Well, 20 years ago now, I mean, those movies are still vital.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, have you seen Network lately? It's practically like it was made last week.
Yeah. but it is fascinating. It's endlessly fascinating. And of course, what can work against a movie in terms of being dated can also work for it because it becomes a time capsule.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes those time capsules are valuable. They inform you. They give you an idea.
Well, they show you what people were like at a certain time. They showed you what they were thinking. That's one of the reasons.
What they were wearing.
Well, that's why I think it's great that when Turner Classic Movies runs an old movie, they generally run it complete if they can get it, including if it has questionable stereotypes or whatever the traffic was bearing at that time. Let's see that. Let's see what people were thinking. Let's know that this was part of the world that people lived in. We recently did a ran-up trailer for The Ghost Breakers with Bob Hope and Willie Best. And Willie Best was a comedian who was always doing scared routines because that's what they allowed black people to do at the time. And he was very good at it. He and Mantan Moreland were, I think, very talented guys who obviously never got to play King Lear or anything because you just couldn't do that. But to cut them out of the movie and not allow people to see their work is worse, I think, than saying, well, you know, this is what these people had to do for a living in order to be – because that's what people thought of these characters. But within that framework, these people were very talented.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And to sweep all that under the rug seems
– It's false. It's false and it's dishonest.
Yeah. And really serves nobody.
No.
Serves nobody. Joe, thanks so much for coming by today.
Oh, thank you.
And
always a pleasure. I figured if I can't figure out an hour's worth of stuff to talk to Leonard about that I'm really in trouble.
What are you hatching anything right now?
I'm hatching a movie I'm going to shoot in Budapest, I hope, called Labyrinthus this summer, mm-hmm. which I hate to put the knock on by actually saying it out loud. Mm-hmm. But it's been in the trades, although it's not the first thing I've ever had in the trades that didn't happen. We're plugging away with the website, and I have a lot of other projects because you can't have just one project.
No, no.
You got to have a lot of projects because if you meet somebody who has money right. – and they don't like what you got. You say, well, I got this, and I got this, and how about this? How about one of these? So you work more for less money, but, you know, hey, it's get out of showbiz. You know,
that's right. That's right. And just like a movie today, a movie that doesn't have at least three logos at the beginning.
That's true.
It just isn't a proper movie. Oh, dear.
Well, thank you, Leonard.
And it's trailersfromhell.com, right?
That's it.
Trailersfromhell.com. You'll thank me. If you don't know it, you'll thank me for recommending it, and you'll get addicted.
Well, you'll waste hours.
Yes, you can waste endless hours, and have a good time doing it. You can find me on Twitter at Leonard Maltin, and you can find me all the time on my website, which is leonardmaltin.com. Thank you for listening. Thanks for tuning in. Tell your friends. Please, please tell your friends. And we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.